Hi, I'm Frances Anderton and this is DNA. Coachella's not just about the music, it's about food, public art, and lights.
You know, these kids now, it's not like, you know, 25 years ago when I started going to nightclubs. You know, it's an educated audience. They're expecting LED walls. They're expecting 1,000 moving lights. They're expecting, you know, scenery and dancers and fireworks.
Steve Lieberman tells us about lighting the Yuma tent and other adventures in illuminating EDM. First up, though, here's a question. What industry has benefited bigly from the Trump administration? Makers of art supplies. Yes, sellers of foam and poster board, paint markers, glue, and other materials for sign making have seen a huge uptick in sales. And that's because so many people have been making signs for protests. And let's not forget about the spike in pink yarn and knitting needles that occurred when millions rushed to make pussy hats for the Women's March back in January. That march achieved enormous impact, in part because in addition to all the posters bearing different messages, it had the unifying image of that pink knitted hat. Coming up, we're going to hear from a curator at the prestigious Victoria and Albert Museum in London about why they acquired a pussy hat. Now, this coming Saturday, April 22nd, which is Earth Day, the March for Science will take place in Washington, D.C. and hundreds of other cities. It's intended to draw attention broadly to the importance of science in policymaking. So are the folks behind the March for Science looking for their own version of a pussy hat? Well, yes, one scientist came up with a turquoise beanie bearing a circuit pattern. Heidi Arges designed the resistor hat and spoke to ABC7 about it.
So the march was on Earth Day, so we chose green and blue to represent the Earth. So hopefully if we can get enough green and blue out on the streets, it'll look like the Earth from above or like an ocean that's flooding the streets.
Or you can download a pattern for a crocheted hat that looks like a brain. Not quite as appealing as the hat with kitty cat ears and rather trickier to make. Alex Bradley is a molecular biologist who's organising the LA March for Science. We called him to find out if he's hoping for some kind of unifying symbol.
Well, the answer to that is sort of both yes and no. It goes kind of counter to our desire to promote free thinking and logical, rational decision-making to enforce any sort of uniform on people. So we decided very early on that that wasn't something that we were going to do, but there have been a couple ideas that sprouted out of our support base, including this knitted brain hat, kind of in the same vein as the Women's March's hats, as well as a lab coat. And both of those, on a personal level, I kind of discourage because I think, you know, a brain hat can be divisive. The point of this march is to really emphasize to the general public why science matters and better communicate the science to them and its importance. And I feel like the brain hat sort of suggests this elitism that, well, we're smarter than you and that's why our opinions are the correct ones. And similarly, I think that the lab coat suggests that this is a march for scientists as opposed to just for science in general. And I think science is something that everyone participates in. So, if the general community wishes to start donning an emblem like that, we would be supportive of it, but we aren't directing that ourselves.
Now, you're running the LA march, but there's marches going on all over the country. Are you in agreement about this nationally, or are there different approaches in different places?
Yeah, that's been the general consensus nationally. What we have done, and I guess this gets back at the last question, as far as my answer to this being yes, is that we've all chosen sort of a landmark or something emblematic of the science in our respective regions for each satellite march. And for us, that was the Griffith Observatory. It just seemed perfect for LA. I think it's a really great example of how important it is that we kind of tie art into science, too. Most of the marches have had a lot of discussions about the importance of STEAM and not STEM. So STEM is science, technology, engineering, and math, mathematics, but STEAM adds the A for arts. And I think if we've learned anything in the past couple decades as the growing mistrust and misunderstanding of science has developed, it's that scientists don't communicate their work well enough, or at least not in an engaging way. And I think the Griffith Observatory is this perfect tie-in into the beautiful architecture and the arts that went into that, which is this, you know, haven for wonderful science. I know when I was a kid and I went to a planetarium for the first time, it was just such an awesome experience. And that I think the Griffith Observatory, which we use as an icon on our modified March for Science logo, just perfectly captures the intersection of arts and science. And, you know, even the very minimal, simplistic silhouette we have of it is instantly recognized by our marchers, and I think that's definitely a powerful symbol.
The march isn't going to be at Griffith Park, though, at the observatory, is it?
No, I think that would be a little bit of a hike for the 50,000-plus people we're expecting to be here. So we're actually, the march is going to take place at Pershing Square.
Got it. So no protest fatigue yet?
You know, I don't think so in the case as far as the science march goes. There's protests every weekend. There are a lot of things that people are very passionate about right now, and they want to stand up in support of. But I think this is unique because when have you ever heard in history that scientists, these typically introspective, socially averse people, as far as we're generally stereotyped, are going to get out along with thousands of others who just want to support the science that they're doing and literally hold up a sign and yell their support of science. It's not something that we thought was necessary before. You know, I think before we thought that it was the nuance of science that would be lost on the general public and not the large-scale consensuses of very important problems.
Alex Bradley, lead organizer for the LA March for Science. It's great to talk to you. Thank you.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. The first museum ever dedicated to design is the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. It was established in 1852 and has a permanent collection of over 2.3 million objects that span over 5,000 years of human creativity. Now added to that collection is a pink pussy hat. It was knitted by Jana Zwyman, one of the team of four LA women who created it. And it was acquired for the museum's Rapid Response Collecting Gallery. That's a strand of collecting that was launched in 2013 with the goal of examining how current global events, political changes, and pop cultural phenomena impact or are influenced by design, art, architecture, and technology. So far, it's acquired around 25 objects. To find out more about this rapid response collecting, we called the curator, Corinna Gardner.
Rapid response is about bringing objects of design into the museum when they are timely and the subject of discussion. And the pussy hat was one of those objects that immediately caught our attention. It's a very modest knitted hat, and it's a pattern that was circulated online. A very straightforward pattern so that those who could or could not knit could become active and have a form of political expression or indeed political allegiance through the making, but then also the wearing of these hats. We, of course, are a design museum, and it's always about how our objects, the designed thing, can tell us about how we live together in the world today. And it's also about design process, design practice, and making. But rapid response in particular is about how the designed world is about how the you and I, the we, all live together in public today.
What was the first object you acquired?
The two objects which in some way formed the genesis of rapid response collecting are Cody Wilson's Liberator firearm, which is a 3D printed gun that was launched in May 2013 in the States. He was at the time a Texan law student, and also a pair of trousers made in Dhaka in Bangladesh at the time of the collapse of the Rana Plaza factory complex.
That killed many workers there.
Indeed, it killed many more than 1,000 garment workers. And the thing that struck us so immediately when looking at the news coverage of this story was that British high street brands, not just British, but ones that were identifiable from the London high street, were seen in the rubble, garments and labels. So what we did was then to go shopping here in London to try and buy the same trousers that we could see in the rubble of the collapsed factory. This is what we did. We brought the object into the museum with a national collection of textiles and fashion, and these trousers, to our mind, enabled us to address these very challenging but not black and white questions of what is fast fashion? What are the implications of being able to buy an inexpensive pair of trousers? What is it in terms of inexpensive garments, building regulation, labour law, and the globalised manufacturing system? So that's the pair of jeans. Of course, the 3D printed firearm is both a question of what are the implications of new technologies, but also in those terms, what does it mean to be able to print a firearm at the push of a button?
Interestingly, you've talked about the Cody's firearm and the pussy hat, and in both instances, the concept was that this was something that could be applied universally. Anyone could download the plastic gun. Anyone can knit the pussy hat. So it's about process as much as it is the end object achieved.
Indeed, and it's very interesting in terms of beginning to be able to look across a series of objects. As I mentioned, we are over 25 in the number we've collected via Rapid Response. And you cannot get away from the fact that we live in a globalized, digital and networked age. Many, many of the objects have that digital component to them, be that downloading of a pattern that you knit. I mean, knitting is a very ancient means of making. 3D printing is something entirely innovative and new.
But when you made that choice to acquire those objects, you didn't decide that you and your staff would knit a pussy hat according to the pattern or set about printing out a gun. You wanted the original nonetheless.
Yes. I mean, this question of the original is a difficult one, particularly in the terms of the digital age. I mean, the very point of Cody's object is that it's multiple. It's freely downloadable and printable in number by anybody. But yes, what we did was go to the source to speak to the designer, to understand the object in its greatest detail through a conversation, an interview, a series of interactions with the designer, because that process of creation, conception and making is so integral to our understanding of that object. But again, what I would add is that Rapid Response is as interested in the object's consumption and its impact on the world. We very much hold to the idea that design is a lens or a means to learn about the world around us, and that's about the object being in context within the complex system that is our everyday.
So interesting. I would actually just like to ask you about one other object that I think you acquired fairly recently, which was the burkini.
Yes. So in the autumn of last year, we put on display a burkini, which again is an object that is highly political in the sense it's a design that's been around since the 2000s. It was developed by a Australian woman in order to enable Muslim girls and women to partake in sporting activities, as is the lifestyle in Australia. But it became an object of considerable discussion and dispute last summer when a number of coastal regional towns in France sought to ban the wearing of the burkini on their beaches. For me, it's an object of migration and demography. It's the changing nature of the society around us. And that material object, one which is to enable women to dress modestly, makes explicit that tension. To think about Rapid Response, these objects come into the museum at a time when they are the subject of discussion, but each and every one has to stand within the collection as an object of design. It's the same process for Rapid Response as it would be for a 17th century inlaid piece of furniture. And it's those points of juxtaposition or the alchemy of the objects in our collections with our new acquisitions that also is a very rich and generative way of thinking about the designed world.
That was Corinna Gardner with the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. Her official title is Acting Keeper of the V&A's Design, Architecture and Digital Department. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. As mentioned earlier, the pussy hat seems to have kicked off a trend in terms of knitted protest statements. Is that how it looks to the creators of that pussy hat? We reached out to Jana Zwyman, one of the four women that created the Pussy Hat Project.
That we have, and it's really exciting to bring the handmade and craftivism to the forefront. And I think in terms of craftivism, yarn and knitted designs have been a part of revolutionary practices and supporting political causes historically. We did not create craftivism, but in the scale that we deployed the pussy hat, we really created a big impact, and it's really wonderful.
so big of an impact that the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, a very prestigious historic design museum, reached out and acquired one of your hats that you personally knitted for its rapid response collecting gallery. How did that feel to have your creation wind up joining the collection at the V&A?
It's incredible, and it's both wonderful and humbling to have work that I created as part of such an institution. And it's the only hat that I did based on the original yarn pattern and the yarn thickness. I tend to knit with thicker yarn so it goes faster. So it's pretty exciting to see. And being a beginner knitter, there are some of those perfect imperfections that are part of it. So it's an individual hat that's representing so many hundreds of thousands of hats that we saw out in DC and other cities for the Women's March.
Jaina, you've several times referenced craftivism. For those that may not have heard that term, what does it mean exactly?
That's actually a fantastic question, and hopefully I can give you a good answer. The way that I think about craftivism is the physical act of making some form of craft to create a political statement. So the pussy hat was a symbol of women's rights and solidarity and political resistance. So it was a craftivism project. There are other projects where people have knitted walls. There are other projects where people have wrapped buildings. There's a form of quote-unquote yarn bombing where people will create yarn installations to make a political point. So there is a history of that. There's also, back in revolutionary times, women were creating liberty caps as a form of political resistance too, and creating knitwear because of protesting taxes from the British.
One always needs to resist the British. And what are you and your three co-creators working on now? Are you still busy knitting hats, or are you thinking, are you onto something else?
So a little bit of a combination of both. You know, in terms of the political climate now, it's more of a marathon than a sprint. So we're having discussions about how to create connections and different forms of instigation. And I think that we created this wonderful community, and the product of the pussy hat is something that you can see, but you can also see through the process that a lot of people have become connected. So we were really laying down some roots for political activism.
So you and your team created the pussy hat at a store, a knitting store called The Little Knittery in Atwater Village, which has quite a following among crafters. Now we're hearing that the owner has to leave that space. Is that correct? And that seems rather sad news, given that that was the kind of birthplace of the pussy hat.
Yeah, it is correct. And it is sad news. Cat Coyle has been at The Little Knittery for years, and her lease was not renewed. So The Little Knittery as an institution is still sticking around. She's signing a lease in a new space that's going to be fantastic and wonderful. And will be announced as soon as everything is ready to be announced as well. But it is really sad because The Little Knittery is a really special piece of Atwater Village. And it's really sad to see it leave that space. So, yeah, stay tuned for where the new place is going to be. And I think it had to do with the landlord's planning to sell the building and didn't renew the lease. So that's part of what happens in Los Angeles real estate. And like all things, it's important to be really nimble. And I think Kat's going to do wonderfully in a new space.
So you're not going to do anti-gentrification hats and... Jaina Zwyman, what a pleasure to talk to you, as always. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Jaina Zwyman, co-creator of the Pussy Hat, now in the Rapid Response Collecting Gallery at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Coming up after this break, music, action, lights. Avishai Artsy finds out how lighting designer Steve Lieberman mixes illumination and sound. Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. We're in between the first and second weekends of Coachella. And if you've been to the festival, you will know that between performances, you can take respite from the heat and the crowds in the Yuma tent. It's an air-conditioned EDM club bang in the middle of the desert. And if you follow electronic dance music, you'll know that part of the total experience is the lighting. DNA producer Avishai Artsy met the man behind the lights.
Audience members don't necessarily look up and notice the lighting guy when everything's going perfectly, but they certainly notice and look up when you've missed blatantly.
This is Steve Lieberman. I'm at Sound Nightclub in Hollywood, which opened 5 years ago. He's showing me the lighting system he designed.
What you'll see here is we have several touchscreens, and then we have some fader wings and like control surfaces. So all of these handles control a different, whether it's a parameter of a fixture, a movement, speed control, there's buttons that make lights strobe, there's buttons that make lights chase, there's buttons that change colors, there's buttons that change patterns. There might, you know, different positions, so when we want to hit the shark, we want to hit the ball, we can hit one of these buttons, and everything's available in an instant.
The shark he's talking about is a glittering 8-foot fiberglass shark covered in mirror panels and Swarovski crystals. Right now it's in the Yuma tent at Coachella. I got to see it at Sound before it was trucked out to the desert.
You know, when you hear this music, if you're a good operator, you can anticipate and you know when the beat's gonna drop, that right on that drop, bam, I wanna hit a color right there.
Steve Lieberman has been designing lighting systems for the biggest EDM clubs and festivals for the last 25 years, including Electric Daisy Carnival, Nocturnal Wonderland, and Ultra in Miami. His interest in electronic music goes back to his high school days in Long Island in the late 80s. He and his friends would sneak into nightclubs in Manhattan.
Things were a little more lax back in those years.
During the summers, he worked at a nightclub in the Hamptons,
which was very Brooklyn, Bronx-centric kind of environment. You know, a lot of guys in, you know, tank tops and a lot of chains and a lot of Camaros in front, and it was that kind of environment.
And then, senior year of high school, a friend took him to his first rave in Sheepshead Bay, Brooklyn.
And I remember pulling into the parking lot of some, grocery store, supermarket, and behind the supermarket was a field. The event was produced by a company called Storm Rave.
Let's do it.
It was Frankie Bones, Adam X, Jimmy Crash. Those were like the techno DJs of those years, and they were also the promoters of this event. And I remember walking around the supermarket into a field and just seeing thousands of kids lined up in the middle of nowhere, metal detectors, and we walked through this field and then went into a warehouse and, you know, hung out and danced till 6 in the morning to thumping, thundering techno music, hardcore. And after that, I looked at my buddy and I was like, oh my God, this is it. And after that, you know, we got involved with another friend who was doing the lighting for these shows. And I happened to have a little Chevy S10 Blazer. So it was enough to throw some lights in the back and probably fit 3 or 4 people squeezed in. So I helped go set things up. I didn't really know what was going on. I didn't know which end of the cable went where. I didn't know how to turn the controllers on. I didn't know what the lights were called, you know, but I knew it was awesome. You went into these environments and it wasn't just, you know, sitting down and listening to a concert. It was like this experience where people congregate together and it was the sum of the parts, right? It was just everything. You became one. And it was really an amazing feeling.
Well, lighting is critical with the advent of EDM as a music and as a scene.
Jason Bentley is KCRW's music director and longtime EDM DJ.
Lighting is a huge part of that experience because it's very immersive. The whole environment is about sensory overload. And so disorienting lighting is a big part of it. Steve Lieberman is probably the best in the business, and he works a lot of different festivals and also smaller nightclubs, sort of on the level with big DJ names. You know, he's sort of that guy. I think he really just invests himself creatively into the whole process. Also, he's really pushed technology and been part of that conversation as all kinds of production elements become more important to these EDM artists.
So how did you get from running the lights at, you know, nightclubs in New York to actually designing the lighting systems, really complex lighting systems, for huge, massive nightclubs and for electronic dance music festivals?
I graduated college in 94. I moved back to New York in 95, and that's when I would say I started my professional career. But in 95, I was still an amateur. But I always had something, there was something in my head that said design, 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 design. Even though I have a degree in history from the University of Arizona, I always knew that I wanted to be a designer, and it was just something like a needle in my brain that I needed to do this part. So I bought myself a laptop and put AutoCAD on it in 1995 and started figuring out how to lay it out in CAD and just do the drawings and taught myself how to do it.
You've designed the lighting for over 200 nightclubs. When you go into it, are you always trying to come up with something new that you hadn't done before, or do you feel like you have maybe a signature style that you bring to most of your nightclub designs?
I would say what I try to do is embrace the structure, embrace the space. When I look at a space, the first thing I do is I look at the lines of the space, I look at the geometry of the space, I look at the architecture. And what I want to do first is I want to make the architecture come alive with technology. So there's just an approach. Every space is a little different, every space has personality, and we try to really enhance the personality of the space with the design.
And so you talk about the expectations of the audience. How do those expectations continue to push you forward?
Well, first, I would say that I'm obsessive, compulsive, neurotic, Jewish kid from Long Island. So right there, there's something in my DNA that makes me a little bit crazy. It actually lends itself very well to design because I have expectations of myself and what I'm going to produce and what my office is going to produce. I think it's proportional with the popularity of the music as well. We're just trying to always do something else, something different, something that the audience hasn't seen before. You know, these kids now, it's not like, you know, 25 years ago when I started going to nightclubs, you know, it's an educated audience. They're expecting LED walls. They're expecting 1,000 moving lights. They're expecting, you know, scenery and dancers and fireworks. And when I went to my first rave, there was 6 lights set up on stage and maybe a smoke machine and 2 strobe lights and a DJ playing on a banquet table. You know, now you come in and we have a $5 million stage set up for you, you know, that's 100 feet tall, 450 feet wide, and accommodates 85,000 people. And we really do our best to create an immersive environment where it feels natural, it feels right, but it's also, you know, it's a fantasy world. You walk in, you're not thinking about your job anymore, you're not thinking about anything else. You walk into Electric Daisy Carnival, you're Alice in Wonderland. You just went down the rabbit hole, and yeah, you're gonna walk into one stage, and the light show is gonna run you over like a truck, and then you're gonna walk into another stage, and there's gonna be a giant caterpillar puffing on a hookah, sending smoke rings into the air, and then you're gonna walk into another stage, and there's gonna be carpet on the ground and a beautiful chandelier overhead, you know, in a completely 360 degree environment, and then you might go outside and go on some carnival rides, and then you can get on the swings and look around and see all the stages swinging around and lights flashing in your face, and we go till sunrise 3 days in a row.
That was Steve Lieberman, founder of SJ Lighting. He was speaking with DNA's producer, Avishai Artsy. And that is it for today's DNA. Ray Guana mixed this episode. Special thanks to Jason Groman. Thank you very much for listening.